Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories along with Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, in the United States, some once-loved stores are trying to understand decreasing sales. Jewelry store Tiffany & Company is an example. Clothing store The Gap and motorcycle store Harley-Davidson are others. These three are more than shopping places. They are brands, public images strongly linked with an object or person. But today's younger Americans in their 20s and 30s are not as interested in buying things from these brands as their parents were. Instead, a store like Target has gained the attention and money of many so-called millennials, people who became adults in the 21st century. Target has been around for more than 50 years. Today, it is the eighth largest seller in the country. One reason is because it has changed its stores for a new generation of shoppers. For example, it started offering more natural foods and designer clothing. It also created a showroom for the latest kinds of things for the home. Target's success shows that the in-store experience remains important. While many Americans are shopping online, just 11% of retail sales are done on the Internet. That means 89% of buying is done in the traditional way, walking into a store, reports the United States Department of Commerce. Target was really stuck, and all of a sudden was able to again drive growth with millennials, says Jason Dorsey. He is president and millennial expert at the Center for Generational Kinetics. Target noticed that millennials shop differently from their parents. Since they are the country's largest living generation, they are important for retailers. They want new things, not the old brands they grew up knowing. They also want adventure and experiences. Finally, they are very concerned with brands that feel authentic. Dorsey said, "What millennials tell us is that an authentic brand has a personality. The brand itself has values." He added that millennials also value convenience. Millennials are expected to be big spenders over the next 10 years. In that time, they will begin to buy things for new homes and start having children. Brands that fail to appeal to these important young shoppers can quickly find themselves in trouble. Millennials will not buy old brands that they think don't really understand or get them, Dorsey says. He says retailers that sell items that seem to be special are likely to do well. In contrast, millennials have not shown much interest in the costly jewelry sold by Tiffany. The 200-year-old brand is now being sold to a French company. At Harley-Davidson, sales of motorcycles have been decreasing since 2014. The brand once represented freedom and the possibilities of the open road. Now, young people want to use ride-sharing companies to move around. And most young people today do not shop at The Gap, whose clothes were once so common they looked like a uniform for Americans in their 20s. You know, millennials are the most photographed generation of adults in history, Dorsey said. In those photographs, they want to send a message, Dorsey explained. They want to show that they buy from stores that treat people well and are good for the environment.
Abdullah Mohammed would do anything to make his daughter happy. That includes forcing himself to laugh with her when they hear bombs explode. The game helps ease the young girl's fears. In Idlib, that means there is a lot of laughter. Idlib province in northwestern Syria is the last opposition-held territory in the country. It has been at the center of a military campaign by Syrian government troops since early December. The Russian military is providing support to the government offensive. More than 900,000 civilians have been forced from their homes since the end of 2019. Many now live in temporary shelters and in open fields near the Turkish border. As the troops neared Mohammed's hometown of Sarakeb 2 months ago, he fled with his wife and daughter to the town of Sarmada. They are now staying in a house there, offered to him by a friend. Mohammed and his 3-year-old daughter, Salwa, have become internet celebrities after a video they recorded was shared widely on social media. In the video, Salwa is wearing a pink dress as she stands on a sofa next to her father. Mohammed asks his daughter, "Is that a plane or a shell?" "A shell," she answers, "and when it falls, we will laugh." As the sound of the explosion can be heard in the distance, the little girl bursts into laughter. Her father laughs with her. Mohammed said he thought up the game to help his daughter deal with her fear. Salwa had been hearing bombs all her life. As a baby, there was no fear, but that changed after her first year. One day, the family was at home in Sarakeb during Eid al-Fitr, the holiday that marks the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Children outside were celebrating with fireworks, and a big one exploded near the family's home. She was frightened, but I took her out and showed her that children were playing and laughing, Mohammed said. That was how he got the idea to connect the sound of bombs with laughter and children playing, and to film himself laughing with his daughter, every time warplanes hit. Mohammed said, now, every time they hear warplanes or artillery shells, Salwa turns to him and waits for his reaction. He pulls out his cell phone to record a video as the two wait to hear the loud noise. Then they laugh. On a recent day, Mohammed sat and watched Salwa as she played with her toys. He said the war has destroyed the hopes and dreams of his generation and those of their children. The most I hope for is to stay alive, along with my daughter and everyone else, he said. We forgot about the bigger hopes. They don't exist anymore.
Scientists say they used new measuring methods to confirm that cloud seeding can produce snowfall under the right conditions. Researchers used radar and other instruments to measure snowfall levels during experiments carried out in 2017 in the American state of Idaho. The experiments involved scientists from several American universities, as well as the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research, or NCAR. A study reporting the results was recently published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Cloud seeding has been tested in parts of the United States since the 1940s. It involves injecting various substances into clouds to produce precipitation, rain, snow, or ice that falls to the ground. The process can cause ice to form and build up inside the clouds until it falls. Some western U.S. states, including Idaho and Colorado, have increased cloud seeding in recent years to help meet a growing water demand. Until now, however, it has been difficult for scientists to measure the effectiveness of the process. Researchers have mainly used instruments to compare the amount of precipitation from seeded clouds to similar clouds that were not seeded. But such studies have brought mixed results. This is partly because many elements influence natural precipitation, which makes it hard to narrow down exact cause and effect results. The research operation over western Idaho was called SNOWY. It involved shooting small amounts of a chemical compound called silver iodide from an airplane into clouds. The chemical can cause water in the clouds to freeze into ice and then fall as snow. In the new experiments, the scientists used radar equipment together with precipitation measuring instruments to collect data. The use of airborne and ground-based radars permitted the team to observe the entire process and compare the side-by-side seeded and unseeded areas, the NCAR said in a statement. In at least three cases, the seeding measurably boosted the snowfall across the targeted watershed, the statement said. In some areas, the cloud seeding created new snowfall where no natural snow existed. One cloud seeding flight resulted in precipitation that produced snowfall for about 67 minutes. The researchers estimated the three cases described in the study produced a combined precipitation total that could fill about 285 Olympic-sized swimming pools. The researchers also used computer modeling to study precipitation measurements during simulated weather activity. The scientists say they hope to use the real results from the new experiments to improve future computer modeling predictions. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The stock market crash of 1929 began a long and difficult period for the United States. President Herbert Hoover struggled to find solutions as the nation sank into the worst economic crisis in its history. But the Great Depression was not the only problem demanding answers from Hoover. The president also had to deal with a number of foreign policy issues. I'm Mario Ritter. With Chris Cruz, we look at how the Great Depression affected relations between the United States and other countries.
My mother told me she passed away, said, "Son, when I'm gone, don't forget to pray, 'cause there'll be hard times, hard times. Oh yeah, yeah. Who knows better than I?"
There were revolutions in South America. Japan launched a campaign of aggression in northeastern China, and the economic situation in America created serious problems in relations with Europe. Hoover succeeded in some areas of his foreign policy, but he failed to solve America's economic troubles. And, like most Americans, he failed to recognize the importance of political changes taking place in Japan and Germany.
Herbert Hoover's foreign policy was marked by his desire to make friends and avoid war. Like most Americans, the new president had been shocked by World War I. Hoover had seen the results of that terrible war with his own eyes. He led the international effort to feed the many European victims of the fighting. The new president was also a Quaker, a member of the Religious Society of Friends. Quakers oppose war. Hoover shared the wish of most Americans that the world would never again fight a major war. To him, the bloody bodies at Verdun, the Marne, and the other battlefields of World War I showed the need to seek peace through negotiations.
Hoover worked toward this goal even before he entered the White House. Following his election, he had several months before becoming president. Hoover used this time to travel to Latin America for 10 weeks. He wanted to show Latin American nations that they could trust the United States to honor their rights as independent nations. Hoover kept his word. The year after he took office, his administration announced that it would recognize the governments of all Latin American countries, including governments that the United States did not like. Hoover told the American people that he would not follow the Latin American policies of President Theodore Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt decided in 1904 that the United States had a right to intervene in Latin America if it disagreed with the actions of governments there. Hoover said this was wrong. He told the country that it was more important to use friendship than to use force.
Hoover withdrew American forces from Nicaragua. He also arranged to withdraw them from Haiti. And he showed restraint as some 50 revolutions shook the nations of Latin America. Some revolutionary governments opposed the United States. They refused to pay debts to American companies, or they claimed ownership of foreign property. But Hoover refused to advance American interests by force. He wanted to prove that the United States could treat Latin American nations as equals. That policy was quite successful. Relations between the United States and Latin American countries generally improved under Herbert Hoover's leadership.
The situation in Europe was much more difficult and much more serious for the United States. The problem was simple: money. The Great Depression did not stop at America's borders. It moved to Britain, Europe, and beyond. And it brought extremely hard economic conditions. In Germany, the value of the national currency collapsed. Inflation forced people to buy goods with hundreds, thousands, even millions of German marks. They lost faith in the system, and they looked for some new leader to provide solutions. The economic crisis also put great pressure on the international circle of debt that had been created after the war. Suddenly, American bankers could no longer make loans to Germany. This meant that Germany could not pay back war debts to France and the other Allied nations in the war to end all wars. And without this money, the Allied nations could not repay money that they owed American banks. The circle of debt fell apart.
Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
The situation grew worse and worse throughout the early months of 1930. Hoover finally had to announce that all nations could delay their debt payments to the United States for 1 year. Hoover's actions did what he wanted it to. It put a temporary stop to the international debt crisis. But it caused great damage to private banks. People lost faith in the banking system. Throughout Europe, people withdrew their money from banks. As a result, the European banks could not repay more than $1 billion that they had borrowed from private American banks.
This was not the only problem. Nations throughout Europe were also forced to take their currencies off the gold standard. This meant their money no longer could be exchanged for gold. The economic situation grew worse, and as it did, serious political tensions began to threaten peace in Asia and Europe.
The threat in Asia became clear first. Japan had defeated Russia in a war in 1905. This victory gave Japan control over the economy of the southern part of what was then called Manchuria in northeastern China. As years passed, Japan began to feel threatened by two forces. First, Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek was trying to organize all of China under the control of his nationalist forces. Second, Russia was extending the Chinese Eastern Railway to the Russian port city of Vladivostok. Japan's army took control of the government in Tokyo in late 1931. The army was fearful of the growing threat to Japan's control of Manchuria, so it moved Japanese troops immediately into several Manchurian cities, and it claimed political control of the whole area. President Hoover and most Americans strongly opposed Japan's aggression, but they were not willing to take any action that might lead to another world war.
Japan's military leaders knew that the people of Europe and America had no desire to fight to protect China. And so the Japanese army marched on. It invaded the huge city of Shanghai, killing thousands of civilians. Western leaders condemned the action. American Secretary of State Henry Stimson said the United States would not recognize Japanese control in these areas of China. But again, Hoover refused to consider any economic actions against the Japanese, and he strongly opposed taking any military action. The League of Nations also refused to recognize Japan's takeover. It called Japan the aggressor in Manchuria. Japan reacted simply. It withdrew from the League of Nations.
Most Americans were not happy about Japan's aggression, but they were not willing to fight force with force. This was less true, however, for Secretary of State Stimson. Stimson was a follower of the old ideas of President Theodore Roosevelt. He believed a nation could only have a strong foreign policy by being strong and using its military power in times of crisis. But Stimson's voice was in the minority. Most Americans did not believe Japan really threatened the security of the United States, and they were not ready to risk their lives to help people in China. Opinions changed only after Japanese planes attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, in December of 1941.
The same story was true in Europe, but France was worried about the rising power of the Nazis in Germany and the fascists in Italy and Spain. France proposed the creation of an international army. Hoover opposed that idea. He called for all nations to reduce their weapons. He believed that negotiation, not force, was the way to solve the problem. But the new leaders in Germany and Japan would listen much more closely to the bootsteps of marching troops than to the high words of peace.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.